Picture this, if you will. A 43-year-old male comes to the emergency department, and you recognize him immediately from the number of times he's been brought in by the police for severe alcohol intoxication. This time, however, he's come by himself, complaining of multiple episodes of dark black diarrhea with a foul odor. You immediately connect him to cardiac and oxygen monitors and find that, despite a normal blood pressure, your patient is tachycardic, with a heart rate of 115 beats per minute. Physical exam reveals multiple stigmata of chronic liver failure, including ascites, spider angiomas, and palmar erythema, but you've seen all of this before. What concerns you is the fact that his conjunctiva and oral mucosa have an unusually pale appearance to them. You consider the possible pathologies responsible for your patient's presentation and the immediate resuscitation he's going to require. And welcome to an episode on the evaluation of gastrointestinal bleeding, a core topic in internal and emergency medicine. I'm Arjun Iyer, bringing topics from gastroenterology from our bricks to your ears. After this episode, you'll be able to 1. Define gastrointestinal bleeding and characterize the clinical presentation as upper or lower GI bleeding. 2. Identify the most common causes of and risk factors associated with GI bleeding. 3. Discuss how GI bleeding is diagnosed and treated. What is gastrointestinal bleeding? A GI bleed is a hemorrhage that associates from the GI tract, anywhere from the mouth to the anus. No surprises there, right? But GI bleeds are dangerous because, unlike a cut on the skin, you can't tell easily from where or how fast the patient's bleeding. Although some bleeds are minor and will stop on their own, others can cause rapid exsanguination or airway compromise. In my field of emergency medicine, GI bleeds are approached cautiously, preparing for the worst, but hoping for the best. Anatomically, GI bleeds are characterized by location as upper and lower bleeds, defined by their position relative to the ligament of Treitz. So, an upper GI bleed could originate from the pharynx, esophagus, stomach, or duodenum, whereas a lower GI bleed is one that originates from the jejunum, ileum, colon, rectum, or anus. To definitively determine the location of the bleed, clinicians use endoscopy to identify and treat lesions in both the upper and lower GI tract. Lower endoscopy is called colonoscopy, and upper endoscopy has the extremely unwieldy name of esophagogastroduodenoscopy, so we abbreviate it to EGD. All right, guys, time for a quick knowledge check. What divides an upper GI bleed from a lower GI bleed? The answer is the ligament of Treitz. There's the possibility that a patient can have a GI bleed, and a gastroenterologist will find no lesions, despite scoping them from both above and below. This used to be called obscure GI bleeding, but as technology's become more advanced, it's now known as suspected small bowel bleed. That's because in these cases, the source is most likely in the jejunum or ileum, beyond the reach of either colonoscopy or EGD, and in these, a capsule endoscopy is often used. It's also possible that the lesions only bleed intermittently, and that the gastroenterologist might have missed it the first time around, requiring a repeat endoscopy. Although clinicians can make an anatomic distinction between upper and lower GI bleeds at the ligament of Treitz, the fact of the matter is, most of us don't have an endoscope handy and have to attempt to localize the bleed based on clinical presentation. Upper GI bleeds can present with hematemesis, which is the fancy term for vomiting either bright red or partially digested blood, commonly referred to as coffee ground emesis because of its brown, grainy appearance. Blood's pretty irritating to the stomach lining, just like iron pills, which is why a lot of people vomit it up. But if it makes its way through the entire GI tract and gets fully digested, it manifests as blackish diarrhea with a sticky tar-like consistency, and it's called melena. Trust me, you only have to see it and smell it once to recognize it forever. Lower GI bleeds often present as the passage of bright red blood per rectum, or hematochezia. Most lower GI bleeds come from the rectum, sigmoid colon, or anus, where the stool is already solid, so blood just sort of streaks the surface of the stools. But lower GI bleeds from the small intestine or ascending colon get mixed in with the stool while it's liquid, so they tend to be diffusely reddish or purplish. Note that these distinctions aren't absolute. For example, a sufficiently brisk upper GI bleed could pass fast enough to result in hematochezia. And to make matters more difficult, a large percentage of GI bleeds aren't severe enough to make you either puke or noticeably change the color of your stool. And these are called occult bleeds. Occult bleeds are often chronic, slow bleeds that are only discovered during a workup for iron deficiency anemia. If you suspect an occult bleed, a guaiac-based fecal occult blood test, or FOBT, can detect microscopic amounts of blood in the stool. Part 2. What causes gastrointestinal bleeding? Just like symptomatology, the causes of GI bleed vary by location and patient demographic. In general, younger patients tend to get upper GI bleeds since the incidence of a lot of the lower GI pathology increases with age. But to get any more specific than that, we got to go into a deeper dive to take a look at some of the more commonly encountered causes of upper and lower GI bleeds. Now, roughly speaking, upper GI bleeding is caused by erosive disease, mechanical injury, or chronic liver disease. Erosive disease refers to peptic ulcer disease and the various itises and opathies of the upper GI tract, and in general, the underlying problem involves an inability of the GI mucosa to protect itself from gastric acid. If you stop to think about it, it's a small miracle that our bodies are able to contain a reservoir of acid in the stomach that's strong enough to dissolve nails without burning a hole in you. The stomach uses several mechanisms to prevent this from happening, including epithelial tight junctions to prevent leakage, and a thick layer of bicarbonate-rich mucus that coats the stomach wall and neutralizes gastric acid before it comes in contact with the stomach wall. Gastric acid is also isolated to the stomach by a set of sphincters, the lower esophageal sphincter, which prevents acid reflux back into the esophagus, and the pyloric sphincter, which only allows acidic chyme to enter the duodenum in short, controlled bursts. And the duodenum, in turn, has its defenses augmented by both the Brunner's glands, which secrete their own bicarbonate-rich mucus, and the buffered secretions from the pancreas and biliary tree, which coordinate with the opening of the pyloric sphincter via hormones like cholecystokinin and secretin. Now, if these protective mechanisms fail, gastric acid progressively damages the mucosal epithelium in what's referred to as erosive esophagitis, gastropathy, or duodenopathy. Gastropathy and duodenopathy refer to non-inflammatory erosions of the GI mucosa, as opposed to gastritis and duodenitis, which are inflammatory. If the acid erodes beyond the muscularis mucosa, it can evolve into a peptic ulcer, a crater-like lesion in the gastric or duodenal mucosa that often has surrounding inflammation and a flat base. On EGD, the base is often covered with exudate, but can be actively bleeding at the time of endoscopy, or even reveal underlying blood vessels. One of the most common causes of erosive disease is overuse of NSAIDs, such as ibuprofen or aspirin. Their mechanism of action involves cyclooxygenase inhibition, and as it turns out, this enzyme is actually critical for the secretion of the protective mucus that lines the stomach. Another relatively common cause of erosive disease worldwide is Helicobacter pylori, a pretty common gram-negative rod. In order to survive the harsh environment of the stomach, H. pylori secretes factors like urease that help it survive by neutralizing gastric acid. Now, that's all well and good for H. pylori, but those secretions actually decrease mucosal protection by provoking an inflammatory immune response. H. pylori infections, by the way, can actually be correctly referred to as gastritis and duodenitis, and are associated with the development of duodenal ulcers. In addition to erosive disease, mechanical injury is also a very common cause of upper GI bleeding. Mallory Weiss tears are the most common and are caused by protracted or violent retching, which makes them common in patients with bulimia or ones that just drank too much alcohol. The sudden increase in intra-abdominal pressure causes these characteristic longitudinal tears near the esophageal junction. Don't worry, though. They're almost always pretty superficial and don't extend past the muscularis mucosa. True full-thickness esophageal perforations from vomiting are pretty rare, but this leads to a much worse phenomenon called Borhoff syndrome. Finally, cirrhosis can also lead to upper GI bleeding in a couple different ways. Cirrhosis refers to the chronic damage to and resulting fibrosis and nodular regeneration of the liver, which blocks blood flow through the hepatic sinusoids. And when portal blood can't flow through the liver, it starts trying to find a way back to the heart through anastomoses in the systemic circulation, most notably in the esophagus. Problem is, these veins are way too small to handle the kind of blood flow that goes through the portal system, so they dilate massively like a balloon that gets blown up just before it pops. These dilated anastomotic veins are called varices, and if you've ever seen bad varicose veins on someone's legs, that's sort of what they look like on EGD. Tortuous, massively dilated, and protruding out into the lumen of the esophagus. But if they do pop, boy is that bad news bears. Not only can the person quickly bleed out from these ruptured varices, but the moment a person starts to pass out from blood loss, they risk drowning in the blood that continues to rapidly fill up the esophagus, even while they're unconscious. I should mention that not every alcoholic patient with a GI bleed has ruptured varices, though. Like I said earlier, patients who abuse alcohol also tend to vomit a lot and are therefore prone to Mallory Weiss tears. Portal hypertension also causes venous congestion of the gastric mucosa, leading to a type of erosive disease called portal hypertensive gastropathy. But because variceal bleeding is potentially life-threatening, any cirrhotic patient or alcoholic patient who presents with an upper GI bleed needs to be taken very seriously. All right, guys, time for a knowledge check. In what patient population do esophageal varices occur? Patients with cirrhosis or portal hypertension are the ones who usually get esophageal varices. So, now that we've reviewed the major causes of upper GI bleeding, let's now focus our attention on the lower GI tract. Probably the most common cause of lower GI bleeding is nothing more interesting than anorectal disease. You know, common stuff, like hemorrhoids and anal fissures. Hemorrhoids are formed from the engorgement of the hemorrhoidal sinuses in the anal canal. The hemorrhoidal sinuses are normal venous enlargements that help seal the anus to maintain continence, but they can become engorged with repeated excessive straining during defecation. Hemorrhoids are classified as internal or external by their position relative to the pectinate line. Internal hemorrhoids arise from the viscerally innervated sinuses proximal to the pectinate line, and external hemorrhoids come from the somatically innervated sinuses distal to the pectinate line. As a result, internal hemorrhoids typically present with painless bleeding because they lack cutaneous sensory innervation. On the other hand, external hemorrhoids can be extremely painful, especially when they thrombose, but are a lot less likely to bleed significantly. Both of them present as bulging masses in the anal canal. External hemorrhoids are always palpable, whereas internal hemorrhoids are only palpable if they're big enough to protrude from the anus. Anal fissures are these painful radial tears in the anal mucosa that are usually caused by straining against hard stool, and the pain is generally exacerbated with defecation. Unlike a lot of causes of GI bleeding, you don't need a scope to diagnose anorectal diseases, because they're right at the anus. An external inspection and a digital rectal exam should tell you all you need to know. Another common cause of lower GI bleeding is inflammatory bowel disease, a family of autoimmune diseases consisting of Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. With IBD, inflammation makes the bowel wall friable, often causing it to bleed. And IBD helps illustrate a good rule of thumb about lower GI bleeding. The more distal the bleed, the more visible it tends to be. Because ulcerative colitis by definition affects the colon, it commonly results in blood-streaked stool or frank hematochezia. In contrast, Crohn's disease most commonly affects the terminal ileum, where the stool is still liquid and the blood can still be partially digested. As a result, the blood gets uniformly mixed in with the stool, meaning that, assuming the same rate of blood loss, Crohn's disease is less likely to produce visible hematochezia, which often leads to delayed diagnosis. Two of the more common causes of lower GI bleeding in older adults are angiodysplasia and diverticular disease. Angiodysplasia is a condition where superficial blood vessels in the colon and in the small bowel dilate with age. And this can cause anything from a cold bleeding to massive hematochezia and frequently requires endoscopic intervention. Diverticular disease is basically the result of tiny herniations of mucosa and submucosa through weak spots in the muscularis layer of the colon. You see, the blood supply of the colon is provided by vasa recta that have to access the mucosa and submucosa by punching holes in the muscle wall, forming a weak spot. Now, if you have a mighty colon exercised by 30 years of high-fiber vegetarian diet like mine, then that's no problem. But when the colon becomes weak and flabby as a result of age-related degeneration or a low-fiber diet, the pressure of peristalsis can cause herniation through the weak muscularis layer, a condition known as diverticulosis. Now, at this point, two different things can happen. Continued herniation leaves the vasa recta exposed, and when the overlying mucosa is eroded, they can rupture and bleed, sometimes quite a lot. Alternatively, these pockets are great places for infection to take root and stagnate, which is what we call diverticulitis. Diverticulosis is usually asymptomatic, but if the vasa recta rupture can cause painless and sometimes quite brisk bleeding, diverticulitis, on the other hand, causes pain, fever, and can generally make you pretty sick, but the bleeding is either generally occult or very mild. Most diverticular bleeds will resolve on their own. However, patients taking anticoagulants are much more likely to have persistent bleeding, making diverticular bleeds actually pretty dangerous in this population. Which patient population tends to get diverticular disease? The answer is older patients and patients who consume low-fiber diets. That's why you gotta work out your colon with some fiber, kids. Finally, neoplasia of the colon is always an important consideration in the differential diagnosis of both occult and frank lower GI bleeding. Colonic polyps are outgrowths of tissue into the lumen that may be precancerous and evolve into colorectal carcinoma over time, meaning that if you find them on endoscopy, you have to remove them and have them sent for tissue analysis by a pathologist. Both colonic polyps and colorectal cancer have increased vascularity and a friable surface, which makes them prone to bleeding. But In keeping with Arjun's law of lower GI bleeding, the symptoms of colorectal cancer will vary based on how proximal they are to the anus. Left-sided neoplasia is more likely to present with a visible GI bleed, whereas right-sided neoplasia more often presents as occult bleeding. Additionally, left-sided colorectal cancer is much more likely to present with decreased stool caliber and even large bowel obstructions, and when combined with the increased likelihood of a frank GI bleed, makes them a lot more likely to be discovered early in their disease course. Colorectal cancer tends to start off as polyps, and it's worth noting that this is actually a pretty common type of cancer. Because intestinal polyps take time to form, colorectal cancer is most common in patients older than 45 years old. Therefore, any elderly patient with an otherwise unexplained iron deficiency anemia should be referred for a colonoscopy to rule out colorectal cancer. Part 3. How do we manage and treat gastrointestinal bleeding? Initial management of a GI bleed should focus on the resuscitation and stabilization of the patient, particularly when GI bleeding is active and severe. Since you can't actually see the bleed, cardiac and blood pressure monitoring provide the earliest signs that a patient may be going into hemorrhagic shock. Good IV access should be established in case you need to start rapidly transfusing blood. And with an upper GI bleed, you should have a low threshold to intubate the patient if it looks like they're going to pass out from blood loss in order to protect their airway and prevent them from drowning in their own hematemesis. Initial labs should include a complete blood count, specifically paying attention to the hemoglobin and hematocrit, but you have to take these values with a grain of salt. Now, you're likely to see microcytic anemia in patients with a subacute or a chronic bleed, and if the anemia is severe or symptomatic enough, they'll need a blood transfusion. But since acute hemorrhage results in the loss of whole blood, you're not likely to see a drop in hemoglobin for many hours. If the patient's hypotensive, hemodynamically unstable, and pouring blood out of their anus, then they still need a blood transfusion, no matter what their hemoglobin is. It's also important to get coagulation studies and assess the platelet levels on the CBC. Impaired coagulation commonly either causes or exacerbates an existing GI bleed, particularly in elderly patients who often take anticoagulants. Other studies can be ordered based on clinical suspicion. For example, in a young patient presenting with bloody stool, you got to rule out an infectious GI pathogen. Now, the presence of white blood cells in stool is a sign that you should follow up the stool evaluation with a stool culture to test for invasive bacterial pathogens. In other parts of the world, parasitic infections are relatively common infectious sources of GI bleeding, and those can be investigated with a stool ova and parasite study. Now, once the patient is stable, most of these patients are going to require endoscopic evaluation to identify and potentially treat the source of the GI bleeding. Like I mentioned, upper GI bleeding is evaluated from above via EGD, and lower GI bleeding is typically evaluated from below via colonoscopy or anoscopy. And both of these techniques can be used to visualize, diagnose, and definitively treat GI bleeding, making them a lot more useful than radiographic imaging. Bleeding esophageal varices, arguably the most emergent cause of GI bleeding, require band ligation, a technique that's also used for hemorrhoids if they become severe enough. Basically, you take a rubber band and use it to tie off the bleeding vessel. In these patients, a TIPS procedure can also be considered to decrease the pressure in the portal venous system by bypassing the liver via a shunt placed by interventional radiology. In the short term, you can use octreotide or the V1 agonist terlipressin to dilate the portal venous system, serving much the same purpose to decrease the pressure in the portal system. And in the long term, you can use a non-selective beta blocker like propranolol that serves more or less the same purpose. It also serves as a prophylactic against variceal enlargement and bleeding. Now, many of the other types of GI bleeds, by the way, also might require endoscopic intervention if there's active bleeding, like peptic ulcers, angiodysplasia, diverticular bleeding, just to name a few. And the specific intervention will vary based on the etiology and the characteristics of the lesion, but some of these techniques can include vasoconstrictor injections, placing surgical clips, electrocoagulation, and laser coagulation. Now, colonic neoplasia in particular requires not only control of the bleeding, but also removal if possible, and biopsy if not, because, like I mentioned, they can be cancerous. You also have to do this to suspicious appearing ulcers that might hide either gastric or duodenal cancer. Finally, all forms of erosive disease, including peptic ulcer disease, need to be treated medically with proton pump inhibitors, since the problem stems from increased susceptibility to gastric acid. It's equally important, however, to treat the underlying cause of the decreased mucosal defenses whenever possible. Most importantly, cessation of NSAID use and antibiotics for H. pylori infections when present. All right, guys, final knowledge check. What is the definitive method of diagnosis and management of a patient with an acute upper GI bleed after medical stabilization? The answer is esophagogastroduodenoscopy, or EGD. All right, friends, let's see if we completed our objectives for this lesson. First, can you describe the clinical presentations of upper and lower GI bleeding? So GI bleeding is divided up into upper and lower GI bleeding based on the relationship to the ligament of Treitz. Hematemesis and melena are typically signs of an upper GI bleed, whereas hematochezia is typically a sign of a lower GI bleed. Next, can you identify the three most common causes of upper GI bleeding? There are three categories of upper GI bleed: erosive disease, mechanical disease, and esophageal varices. Erosive disease, including peptic ulcer disease, is probably the most common cause. Mallory Weiss tears are mechanical trauma caused by increased intra-abdominal pressure during vomiting. Finally, people with cirrhosis or portal hypertension can develop esophageal varices, which lead to massive hematemesis upon rupture. Next, can you identify three common types of lower gastrointestinal bleeding? The most common cause in younger patients is anorectal disease, namely hemorrhoids and anal fissures. Other causes of lower GI bleeding tend to have increased incidence with age, including inflammatory bowel disease, angiodysplasia, diverticular disease, and colonic neoplasia. Finally, what is the definitive diagnostic and therapeutic modality for most forms of gastrointestinal bleeding? Endoscopy is the first-line therapy to visualize, diagnose, and treat most GI bleeds, EGD for upper and colonoscopy for lower GI bleeds. However, medical resuscitation takes priority in unstable or questionably stable patients, and many patients with GI bleeding require maintenance with medical therapy, even after endoscopy, especially PPIs in patients with erosive disease of the upper GI tract. Now, armed with your newfound knowledge, let's get back to that patient from the intro. A 43-year-old male with a history of alcohol abuse and stigmata of chronic liver disease presents to the emergency department tachycardic and pale, complaining of multiple episodes of what you suspect is melena. What diagnosis are you most concerned about? What intervention does your patient likely need? And how do you plan to medically stabilize him until then? The patient's presentation is characteristic of a serious upper GI bleed. And while patients who abuse alcohol may have many different reasons to bleed, you worry most about the possibility of ruptured esophageal varices. In the time it takes to connect the patient to the monitor and establish large-bore IV access, the patient has another two episodes of frank melena, and his heart rate jumps from 115 to 130 beats per minute. You don't need to see a hemoglobin level to tell you that the patient's rapidly progressing towards hemorrhagic shock, and you rapidly transfuse 2 units of packed red blood cells while paging the gastroenterologist to perform definitive identification and control of the source of the GI bleed. You order octreotide empirically to decrease the portal blood pressure in case of a ruptured varices, and pantoprazole in the event of a GI bleed from erosive disease. The gastroenterologist calls you back to tell you that he's coming in right away, but the moment you hang up the phone, the patient vomits about 250 cc's of bright red blood and starts to look woozy. Fearing that he might not be able to protect his airway, you intubate the patient just as the gastroenterologist arrives to perform an emergent EGD. He discovers multiple esophageal varices and performs band ligation on the bleeding vessel, definitively controlling the bleeding. And that's our show. Make sure to like and subscribe if you like what you heard. And remember, your feedback helps us improve. You can enjoy the full BRICS experience online at www.usmle-rx.com, complete with illustrations, questions, flashcards, and active learning. So go check that out if you haven't already. Until next time, friends.